Okay, we're beginning the book of Shmuel, and the book of Shmuel begins with a description. We have a Levi. Remember, we ended the book of Shoftim with a Levi from the mountainous region of Ephraim. Now we begin the book of Shmuel with another Levi from the mountainous region of Ephraim. This Levi is called Elkanah. And Elkanah is a descendant of Korach.
Who's Korach?
Remember Korach? He rebelled against Moshe.
Oh, yeah, the rebellion.
So Elkanah is a prophet, and Elkanah is a tzaddik. And Elkanah travels among the Jewish people, teaching them Torah, and bringing them back to the way of Hashem. If you recall, we learned at the end of the book of Shoftim to what a spiritual decline and moral decline the Jewish people had reached. We have a whole tribe of Dan in the north with an idol in their midst. We have the tribe of Benjamin has a terrible act in their midst, and they stand up to fight so that they can implement their own justice with those people. We have civil war. We have the people of Yavish Gilad who seem disinterested with the morality of the Jewish people. They don't even join the civil war, not on this side nor on that side. They're just living in their own territory. And all of this is taking place when Samson is behind bars. Ain melech b'Yisrael. There's no king around, no one to take care of what's going on. So the book of Shmuel is going to focus us on the need for the king, the need for a leader, the need for a dynasty, the difference between a king and a shofet. There are five differences, but one of them is that the king, well, his son is king. There's a dynasty. The shofet, we don't find any shofet whose son was a shofet after him. Possibly, according to one opinion, Manoach was a great leader and his son Shimshon was a great leader. Possibly. But at any rate, the book of Shmuel is going to focus us. The book of Shoftim focused us on the great morality of the Jewish people in spite of the fact that they didn't have a king. We discussed that in the beginning of the book of Shoftim. But at the end of the day, we have a description of how the Jews always went back into spiritual decline because when the Shofet died, so there was no one there to teach them right from wrong. The book of Shmuel focuses us on the appointment of the king and the development, the beginning of the Davidic dynasty. So we have this unique man, this unique tzaddik who travels throughout Israel teaching the Jewish people Torah. And this man has two wives. He married a woman of his caliber, a woman named Hannah, a woman who is also going to attain prophecy. We learn the laws of prayer, some of the laws of prayer we learn from her. And this woman has no kids. And he has another wife named Peninnah. Peninnah gives him 10 children. And Hannah has no children. And year by year, he travels up to Shiloh during the three regalim, the three periods when we bring sacrifices. And when he'd go to Shiloh, he'd take a different route every year. Now imagine if the chief rabbi of Israel were to come to your neighborhood and set up camp with his family. This is bigger than the Shabbos in Herzliya, guys. He came with all his entourage. You're talking about the chief rabbi, Elkanah, the prophet. Imagine a prophet came to town with his whole family. So everyone would come to see his tent, to see how he's doing, and to ask him their questions. And they'd ask him, Rabbi, where are you headed? And Elkanah would say, oh, I'm going up to Shiloh. And the people would say, Shiloh? Shiloh? I haven't been in Shiloh in ages. They'd go back home and they'd say to their wife, you know, it's been a long time since we were up at Shiloh. What did you say we join them? And slowly but surely, every year he'd have a huge caravan going with him. And every year he'd take a different route from Har Ephraim to Shiloh. And slowly but surely, there was a ripple effect. And all of the Jewish people started going up to Shiloh. Now we have to understand the importance of that. The book of Melachim, the next book we're going to learn, describes the period of the first temple, and after Shlomo, the Jewish people start becoming pagans throughout the north, the south. Jews, they believe in God, and they also bring all these private sacrifices at home. And the way that Chassam Sofer explains that was that it wasn't easy to travel up to the temple. And if God says you may not bring a sacrifice at home, only at the temple, so the people, they say, well, I can't make it to the temple this year. How am I going to leave my family? Remember, in those days, traveling, who's going to take care? Who's going to cut the firewood? Who's going to take care of the family? And the traveling was long and tedious and expensive. So people were at home and they wanted to worship God at home. You don't have the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. You don't have the institution of Shmoneh Esrei three times a day. People feel a yearning to connect to God. Those of you who are in the gear process know what this is. When you don't have a system and you don't know how to connect with God, and you're far away and you don't have a temple, you don't have any way to connect. So you go online, and the way many people do when they start doing tshuva, they go online and they click on Kiddush Friday night. And they listen to someone chanting Kiddush, so they have something. Well, once upon a time, there was no internet, guys. Believe me, when I was a kid, there was no internet. And once upon a time, there was no Facebook, right? And there was also there were no CD players and no telephones, and how'd they survive, right? And there were no 8-tracks and no LPs and no cars, right? So a guy is out in Sfat and he wants some spirituality, and he has nothing. He's alone. And his neighbor says, I want spirituality too. And you know what? Rabbis weren't easy to come by in those days. So what did they do? A group of people would get together, build an altar, take an animal, slaughter it, and say, God, this is for you. And they burn it. And they say, let's do something. Our neighbors, look, we see they're bringing sacrifices all over. We'll bring sacrifices. Now what happens? Their kids come out to the yard, and they say, Dad, what you doing? Dad says, I'm bringing a sacrifice. Oh, beautiful. Yeah, I see our neighbor there. He also does that. He goes up to the neighbor. What you doing? I'm bringing a sacrifice. He asks the neighbor, what are you doing? You bring a sacrifice. Me? I pray to Zeus. I pray to Aphrodite. I have all these. He goes back to his father and says, Dad, what you doing? You bring a sacrifice. He says, oh, I pray to God. There's God up in heaven. He created the world. The kid starts looking at the crops. Gee, the neighbor's business is doing fine. Dad's business is doing fine. The neighbor's business is outdoing Dad's business. I think when I grow up, I'm going to do his way. Slowly but surely, the children, the next generation, started bringing their altars, and it always led to idol worship. Because if people are building their own altars in their backyard, and there is no Torah as to how to bring a sacrifice in your backyard, because the Torah doesn't allow it for much of Jewish history. There were periods in Jewish history when it was permitted. But when people are doing their own thing, so just like conservative became reform, today you read what the conservatives believe and you'll see there's really no difference. I mean, they don't believe that Tanakh is from God. That you don't even have to believe in God to be a conservative Jew. Right? So the second you break the tradition, so then there's no limit, because the kid says, okay, you did this the way you wanted, so I'll do that the way I wanted. How can you tell your kid, you can break tradition, but marry Jewish? What do you mean? Why should you decide for me where I should limit the breach in tradition? If you breach, I breach. So when the first generation started bringing their own private altars, so then the next generation continued, but they went the next step. And that's why we find throughout the book of Melachim that the Jewish people were becoming pagans, time and again. When Elkanah starts traveling throughout Israel and reminding people there's Shiloh, there's that central place where you have Kohanim and you could learn Torah, so he's ensuring that the Jewish people are not only connected to the Torah through him and his travels, they're also connected to the center of Torah learning. It's like having Arutz Meir as your homepage. You turn on the internet, the first thing you see is, there are Shiurim, let's see what's on there. People have three times a year when they take a break for their work to celebrate the holidays, they're also going up to Shiloh. That was one of the keys that Elkanah succeeded in bringing the Jewish people back, because he reconnected them to that center of spirituality, Shiloh. Yes, Gidon.
I'm just wondering, at this time, I understand that they didn't have Yerushalayim in their possession until King David, you know, so they must have known that they know its holiness. Like, did anybody ever try to go there? What did they think about Har Habayah, or they didn't know about it, or?
So the Torah purposely conceals where the temple would be built. The Torah calls it the place. We had a tradition. Adam knew where it was. Noach knew where it was. Avram knew where it was. Yitzchak knew where it was. The Torah doesn't reveal it. in the Parsha class, we've discussed often that there are multiple reasons why the Torah didn't want to reveal it. One of them was to ensure that the nations wouldn't come and create their own temple there. If the Torah would explicitly write, "This is our holy place," you'd have what you have today. Where the Arabs, you know, in the Arab media, they don't call it our temple. They don't call it the Temple Mount. They call it, whenever they'll refer to what we call the Temple Mount, they'll say the Jewish purported claim of the Temple Mount. The Arab media describes it as a lie. You know, it's like saying that the purported claim, there's a word that they add, which in Arab means the claim of. Meaning they'll never call it the Temple Mount. That's why the Mufti up there is so busy with so many truckloads of artifacts that they keep shipping out of Har HaBayit. They're digging and digging and digging over there to take out any remembrance, any testimonial that says we have any claim to it. Arafat said it to Clinton. That's when Clinton fell off his seat. Arafat said to Clinton, they have no claim to the same. They were never here before us. It's a myth.
Frequent guests of the White House.
That's it. Arafat said that to Clinton. Clinton looked at him like, are you serious? That's the Arab claim. The Arab media, the next generation already believes it. I mean, you talk to an Arab today, he's like, you guys are all liars. You were never here. Look, I mean, so the Torah wanted to preclude the nations from trying to create a claim to Har HaBayit. So the Torah doesn't say where Har HaBayit is going to be. We had a tradition, and we will learn later on in Shmuel how it was figured out by King David, how he figured out where Har HaBayit was supposed to be from the Torah. But the Torah hides it. The Torah doesn't say it overtly. So at this point, Yerushalayim was not yet the chosen place. It was Shiloh. Shiloh was where the Mishkan was. And we're out of time. We'll pick up Bezalel next week.